Blog Talk Radio.
Finally, I'm finally free. Finally, I'm finally me. Finally, I'm finally free.
Installment of the Black Girl Nerds podcast. My name is Jamie. I am your host. Tonight we have an amazing topic. Afrofuturism is our topic. So if you've ever had questions about what is Afrofuturism, then please, please take notes during this show. This will definitely be one of those shows that are very insightful and give you a lot of feedback that you may not have gotten before. Our guest is Rashida Phillips. She is the creator and founder of the Afrofuturist Affair. So if you have questions, please call us. Our phone lines are open. Phone number is 347-237-4616. Or if you're a little phone shy, that's okay. You can always live tweet us via the BGN Podcast hashtag. And we're also on Twitter at BGN Podcast. So please follow that account for updates throughout the show. All right, so before we get started, I do want to say happy Easter to everybody, happy Resurrection Day, however you celebrate, whether it's religious or secular. Happy Easter to all of you guys. Hopefully you had a really great dinner, had an opportunity to spend time with family and friends, and really just take advantage of having a nice, relaxing Sunday. One of the things that I always like to announce from week to week is our Zazzle store. We have merchandise on there. You can purchase it. So the name of the store is called Blurgasm. And if you go to www.zazzle.com/blurgasm, you can purchase T-shirts, coffee mugs. We've got keypads, mouse pads, keychains, rather, mouse pads. And it's got both of our logos on there. We have our old logo and our new logo. So the old logo's got the glasses with the curly font with a nice little whimsical design to it. And then we've got our new logo created by Kayona Ebony Brown from Of Music and Men. That's got more of a sleek, professional look to it. So if you like one logo over the other, check that out. If you want to get both, even better. Or if you're like, you know what, I really don't want to get any merchandise, but I do want to support you guys, you know, financially. So you can do that. You can go to our website. It's www.blackgirlnerds.com. If you go to the right sidebar, there's a PayPal link, the donate button. Click on it, and all of the proceeds and the monies used to support Black Girl Nerds podcast does go back into funding these. These podcasts do get rather expensive. They're not cheap. So we want to be able to stay on week to week and give you some really great entertaining content to listen to. So before we get started on introducing our guests, I do want to pass the virtual mic over to our co-hosts. We have Ashley Brittany with us. So we will start with Brittany and then Ashley. Tell us what's going on in your lives, anything new. Also, give us your social media shout-outs and website shout-outs.
All right. Hello, I'm Brittany. I am a mother. My daughter's name is Olivia. I'm expecting another little girl that I will name her Brooklyn. What else is going on? I'm trying to go back to school to be a nurse, which should be very fun. And also I want to shout out because my daughter said she wanted to say hey to all nerds. I don't know how I feel about that, but that's what she wanted to say to everybody. But you can follow me on Twitter, Natural Girl. That's all one word, Natural Girl 89. I do not bite on Twitter. I actually talk too much. So, yeah, follow me.
I'm Ashley. I am a Philadelphia-based writer who is the founder of Graveyard to Sisters, which is a Black women in horror blog, website, whatever you want to call it. We also have a Facebook page. It's facebook.com/graveyardshiftsisters. I'm on Twitter way too much at graveyardsis, that's S-I-S. And I'm always looking for new contributors. And I just got invited to Geek Girl Con for a panel on women in horror, so I'm extremely excited.
Woohoo! Yay!
Yay!
All right, and somebody has TV going on in the background. There's some feedback, so whoever it is, it's you can hear it. Just giving you a heads up. All right, so I'm going to go ahead and introduce our guest, and we're going to go right into the topic about Afrofuturism. Rashida Phillips is a Philadelphia public interested attorney of speculative and also a speculative fiction writer and the creator of The Afrofuturist Affair and a founding member of Metropolarity.net. She recently published her first speculative fiction collection called The Recurrence Plot and Other Travel Tales. Please welcome Rashida to the show.
Thank you. Thank you. Hi. Happy Easter.
Hi, Rashida. Thank you so much for coming on today. I just want to start with a question that I think a lot of people do have. It's a word that we hear a lot now. It's kind of become a new buzzword. What is Afrofuturism?
Okay, so I'm going to give sort of the, I guess, textbook definition of Afrofuturism, which is that it's sort of an umbrella term for the Black presence in science fiction, technology, magic, and fantasy. It was coined by a cultural critic named Mark Derry back in, I believe it was 1993 or 94. And his notion of it when he was writing about it in an essay called Black to the Future was that speculative fiction, he thought of it as speculative fiction that treats African-American themes and addresses African-American concerns in the content in the context of technoculture, and, you know, just sort of more generally our presence in technology and in the future. And what he said is, for want of a better term, call it Afrofuturism, and that's sort of where it came from. I think I sort of see it the same way. It's the black presence in speculative fiction, in speculative sort of genres, in speculative notions. But at the same time, the term is of a fairly recent creation. However, we also use it to look retrospectively back at people of color or black people in speculative fiction and film and art. So, for example, we call Sun Ra an Afrofuturist. Obviously he was around before the term was coined, but we can use it sort of as a lens to look back at these things and say, oh, well, that has Afrofuturistic phenomena in it, and that looks Afrofuturistic. So it's sort of a language that we have to look at the black presence in technology in the future, even in the past, you know, to be able to go back and reexamine the past and see how people in the past thought of the future and what the future looked like for them.
And I'm going to ask this other question and then toss it over to Ashley and then Brittany to ask their questions. How has Afrofuturism evolved since it was first coined by Mark Derry in 1993?
So I think Afrofuturism, when it was first coined, it was sort of positioned in the academia. So I know it was coined back in 94 in his essay. And then Alondra Nelson, who is also a scholar and professor, she picked up on it and was already working with those themes in her work. So I think conversations began between scholars. There was a listserv that started, an Afrofuturism listserv, where, again, they had these different conversations about the culture and about what Afrofuturism meant and what it could mean. And then from there, it evolved. There's a website called Afrofuturism.net, which I believe is where the listserv evolved into. And that website has a host of, like, essays and resources and various lists about Afrofuturism and people who have produced Afrofuturistic work. So I think from there it evolved even further into people, you know, beginning to create art and consciously create work using Afrofuturistic themes. And then people started having events, and that's sort of where I came into the whole thing a few years ago in terms of starting my organization and my events around Afrofuturism themes.
Good stuff.
Yeah. Very interesting. Yeah, so I think where it is now, I think that it's evolving. I think, it started sort of in academia, but it's now a culture and a lens and a way to create. And, you know, it's sort of moved beyond just being something you talk about or a point of critique or analysis, you know. So it's really interesting, I think.
So my interest primarily stems from, I love the fact that subcultures and concepts are become this way of creatively producing, being a creative production space. And so I think about how, you know, the youth kind of adapt their own ways of being creative and being productive in these spaces as well. And since Afrofuturism is so old, I think my first question, I know you have a daughter, and I'm really interested in, like, you know, if she has those kinds of, you know, has an affinity for, you know, the speculative, and how do you if it's because it's such a part of your life, like, do you feel like it will impact her interest and identity as she grows?
That's a great question. So my daughter's 15 years old, and, you know, even before, so I just sort of became familiar with the term itself back in 2011, right, you know, just a few years ago. But all of my life I've been an Afrofuturist. You know, even when I didn't have a language for it, I was into science fiction, I was into the speculative, and it's always been a part of my life. So I think by virtue of that, you know, I've sort of consciously raised my daughter with those interests and with those, just the notion of open possibility, which I think Afrofuturism also represents, you know, just like you just said, you know, you can sort of enter Afrofuturism from anywhere, even though it, you know, again, its origins are sort of academic. But I think what it is now, you can enter it from any place and, you know, find a place in it and find a home in it. So I think I've always sort of had these concepts in mind and the thought of possibility and the thought of creating a future. And I've definitely have passed these things down to my child. And, you know, in a sense, I've lived, you know, I had my daughter at a very young age. I had her at the age of 14 and, you know, for a couple years until I got out of the rut, sort of what it meant to be a teen mom and sort of took control of that and took agency of it, I very consciously created a path for myself and for my child. And again, just, you know, sort of instilled those sort of values from the start, you know, just the thought of being able to create your future. And again, and I think that's what Afrofuturism represents. So, yeah, she's very, you know, in tune with these things. She's not as much of a sci-fi head as I am, but she's definitely a fantasy and, you know, a little bit of horror here and there. And, you know, she likes these things, but she's not yet into it as much as I am. But she is, you know, she's an artist in and of herself. You know, she writes and she's in acting school. She's in a performing arts high school. So yeah, I think, you know, the concept of Afrofuturism or what it means in the community and to me as an individual has definitely passed on and how I raised my child and the things that she's interested in now.
Okay. Yes, I have to evolve my question. with Afrofuturism, I was wondering, does it only deal with science? Because I know you said that there's a lot of academic around it. What all else comes with it?
I think it does deal with science primarily. I think it deals with science in the same way that sort of sci-fi deals with science. So science is a part of our lives. You know, it's a daily, moment-to-moment part of our lives in some respects. And I think Afrofuturism gives us a way to make science and scientific concepts accessible to us, because even though they're an everyday part of our lives, when we think about science, you know, we think about scientists and we think about things that are out of reach for us. And I think science is a very, you know, it should be accessible, it should be in reach, and it should be something that the common person thinks about and uses and deals with. So I think Afrofuturism gives us a way to do that and to envision how science affects our lives in a daily way and how it will affect our lives in the future. But I think, you know, there are things that lie outside of science that Afrofuturism deals with. I think it deals with fantasy, and I think it deals with, you know, it's how you define it. And, you know, I do think it's inclusive in certain respects. So, yeah, I'm not really sure how to answer that, but I think that it primarily deals with science and it gives us a way to redefine it, to reexamine it, to reclaim it, in a sense.
All right.
Beautiful. We do have a guest or a caller, rather, I should say, that's on hold. So I think they're waiting to speak to us. So I'm going to bring you on. Area code 860, you're on the line with Black Girl Nerds. What's your name and where are you from?
That's me. My name is Rod. I'm calling from Connecticut.
Hey, Rod. How's it going?
Hello. Hello, Rashida.
Hi.
How you doing today?
Great. Thank you.
Good. Just calling in because I'm a sci-fi buff myself ever since seeing Ear Theater. As you get to hear the clips live. I'm sure you'll quickly join the ranks of Octavia Butler. I noticed that time travel on your book, so I wanted to ask you if you'd give us a quick synopsis of your book, Recurrence.
Of course. So the book is called Recurrence Plot and Other Time Travel Tells. It's a collection of stories that I've written over the past 5 years or so, all that involve time travel from different aspects. I've studied a lot of quantum physics, and I found a lot of quantum physics was applicable to life in certain respects and to certain experiences that I've had being a young parent and some other things that I've dealt with. And, you know, I noticed these various cycles in my life and in the lives of others. And, you know, so I just use time travel basically as a metaphor to get at those things and to get at the thought of trauma and past history and, you know, the sort of the double consciousness that we sometimes feel as Black Americans and all of those things I sort of explore. Again, through the metaphor of time travel, because I find it to be a very potent metaphor that allows us, and not even just a metaphor, really, you know, part of what the book is talking about is that time travel is really an everyday reality. And again, it's getting at this notion that science and time travel and all these concepts are something that we should have access to and something that we should be defining utilizing and not just something that should be kept in the hands of, you know, scientists or someone with a degree, because it affects all of us. That's really what the book is about, and it's the stories are all interrelated, and the central story is called Recurrence Plot, and all of the different stories relate to that one story in a sense, but they are all standalone stories. And it also has to choose your own adventure in it, and it has a time travel manual embedded in it, and it's sort of metafiction and all sorts of fun stuff in there. So, yeah.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of sci-fi. I love that stuff.
Yeah.
So is this book available in, like, a Kindle form? Or, I mean, how can we get a hold of your book?
It's available in every form, every format. It's available on Smashwords.com. Which is an ebook format, which has Kindle and all of the various ebook platforms. It's also available on Kindle if you go on Kindle, or on Amazon if you go and type in Rashida Phillips or Recurrence Plot. And then it's also available through my website, AfrofuturistAffair.com, through the website of my collective, Metro Polarity. So, yeah, it's available in print and via ebook.
Oh, okay, great.
Yeah.
I'll be looking for your book.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
I'll send you a tweet as soon as I finish it.
Yes, please do. Yes. I would love to hear your thoughts.
All right.
Thank you, Rod. Thank you for calling in. Appreciate it.
See you later.
Take care. So you mentioned Afrofuturist Affair. I wanted to ask you, what inspired you to create this website? And tell us more about the Tumblr site, Afrofuturist Affair.
Yeah, sure. So the Afrofuturist Affair is sort of a long journey. Like I mentioned earlier, I've sort of always have been interested in sci-fi, and I've always written sci-fi since I was a kid. And, you know, when I went to college, I went to Temple University, and I started taking classes in the African-American Studies department. And, once I started – it'll do you. It'll turn you over to the other side. Like, I just became this whole other person because I came into my consciousness as a Black woman, and so that – from there changed my world. And so from there I sort of had to distance myself from the notion of science, sci-fi, because I didn't find myself reflected in it. So for a long time I didn't really deal with sci-fi, but then a friend handed me Octavia Butler's novel Kindred, because she was like, you know, I've read your work and I feel like you would resonate with this. And I had heard of Octavia Butler, but I hadn't read anything by her, and you know, I just wasn't really familiar with her. But as soon as I read that, that was like a homecoming for me. It was like going to church. Like, the concept of a Black woman protagonist in a sci-fi novel was just like, you know, it just blew my mind. So from there, I was really inspired to start writing again. And after I started writing, I wanted to have a platform to where I could share my work and find other people of color who were writing science fiction and Black science fiction. And then through some other various channels, I came across Black Science Fiction Society website and found that was like a haven for Black sci-fi. And I wanted to throw an event. Basically, that's what happened. And I was poking around on the Black sci-fi website and saw that there was an Afrofuturism exhibit at the Harriet Tubman Museum in Georgia. And like I said, I've been like sort of playing around with this idea of having an event or doing something to where I could share my work and other people could share their work. And I saw that and I was like, oh, I want to go to that so bad, you know, blah, 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 but it's all the way in Georgia. And then it took me like a couple more times of like looking at that invite to where I was like, why don't I do this in Philly? And that's sort of how it started from there. The Afrofuturist Affair originally started as one event. It was just like a ball, a costume ball, where I could, you know, showcase my work and showcase the work of other people who either define themselves as Afrofuturists or had, you know, dabbled in these concepts and may not necessarily have called themselves Afrofuturism, but that I noticed or saw or felt like it fit into that. And so it started off as a showcase of performance and art and readings, sci-fi readings. That was back in October 2011. And I started the Tumblr as a way, because I had my own personal Tumblr, and everything I was reblogging was, like, sci-fi stuff. And I was like, why don't I just start a Tumblr so I can put all that stuff on there, another Tumblr, and then also so that I could, you know, put out news and profiles about the people who were performing in my event. And then from there, it was like it got people started following it, and I was like, all right, I might as well just keep it going, and that's sort of where it went from there. And I think I started the event at a time when Afrofuturism was starting to grow, and you know, I just came in at a very fortunate time, and you know, the concept was just automatically intuitive for me. You know, just hearing that word Afrofuturism, I didn't know what it meant. I had never heard it before, but it just hit me like, oh, this is what I'm doing. This is what I've been doing. I have a language for it now. I have something to call it. And yeah, and I think that's what happened. So, yeah, the Tumblr, our primary, we do a couple different things. Our primary is throwing creative events, and we use all of the proceeds for the events for a grant that we have now. And previously we were donating it to other social services and social justice organizations, but we started our own grant eventually. And so we do events. We write, you know, creative writing. Also the blog, so which is just, you know, meant to be a platform, again, and a place to share Afrofuturist-inspired creation, artwork, events, things like that. And yeah, it's blown up, and I'm very grateful for that. So,
hey, Rashida, I know, just a side question, just real quick. Were you able to see Octavia Butler when she was at Temple? I think we were both still there at the time. So.
No, I didn't. I missed her. Yep, I missed out on that whole, you know, it's really sad that, again, I didn't really get into her until, like, shortly after she had passed, because, yeah, she was alive.
Wow, okay.
You know.
Yeah.
And,
mm-hmm.
It was interesting. So, yeah. Sad.
That was the same for me. I didn't really know much of her work until after she passed, and it's a shame. You don't really hear a lot about her work in educational institutions and schools. I mean, I went to an HBCU.
No,
yeah, I went to a Black university and never heard of Octavia Butler.
That's crazy.
One course, no mention of her name, and I was like, wow, how did I not know about this woman and her wonderful work?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm glad what you're doing with Afrofuturist Affair, because then people can really get to know her work along with other writers that are similar to what she's done. So let me ask you this. Is Afrofuturism celebrated in all communities, or is it just within the Black community?
I think that's a good – that's an interesting question. You know, I'm going to throw a disclaimer that this is totally my opinion, of course. I think Afrofuturism is for Black people, period. You know, I think Afrofuturistic production can only be organically created by and for Black people. You know, and I think that comes as a conflict sometimes, because the term itself was coined by a white man, you know, and makes me feel – you know, and I had a conversation with him about this a little bit, and I think, you know, I don't know if I should be talking about this, but whatever. like in another interview I had said, you know, I think it's problematic that the term was coined by a white man. And, you know, he took issue with that, and understandably. But my rebuttal to him was that, you know, the fact that it's coined by someone that is a part of, or whose identity is wrapped up with an oppressive group, and this is supposed to be for us, that's what makes it problematic. You're not problematic yourself, you know, but your social status is, you know. But, you know, when you look at it like that, anything, you know, any term that we use to identify ourselves could have been coined by a white man, you know, even calling ourselves African. You know, I've searched and searched for the origin of that term, and I can't find a you know, one source or an accurate source about that. So that comes along with language itself. You know, any term can be problematic, but I think it's good enough. You know, it's something that we have for now, and it might evolve into something, but I think it's a good enough term. But anyway, to get back to the question, I think white people can enjoy it and can participate in it, and they do. I mean, white people come to my events all the time, and they appreciate it, and they understand it, but I think that you have to know your boundaries. You know, if you're going to participate in it and you're outside of the culture that it's aimed at, you have to meaningfully participate, know your boundaries, not try to take over the concept, not try to gentrify it, or, you know, approach it from this anthropological analysis, you know, sort of way. And I think that they have to understand that they're not going to completely get it, and that's okay, you know. So that's sort of my opinion. But I think Afrofuturism doesn't discriminate. You know, I think in and of itself it's just open to possibilities, and it's open to having these difficult conversations that we have, and we have been able to, you know, using the language of Afrofuturism. So I respect it, and I love it for that reason. But again, I think, you know, in terms of cultural production, creating Afrofuturistic art and work, I think, you know, it has to be organic, and it has to come from someone who has had the experience of a black person. You know, that's just my thought on it.
Rashida?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. It got really quiet for a second.
Yeah.
Did you guys lose?
So we got a question from Twitter. This is from India at India's Movies. She wants to know, what are your daily, weekly, monthly routines of learning and teaching Afrofuturism?
Oh, daily routine. Yeah, it's definitely a daily routine. You know, I work 9 to 5. I have a 9 to 5 job. I'm an attorney at Community Legal Services, which is a nonprofit legal services organization, and I serve people who can't afford attorneys, and I do housing work. So even to me, that work is Afrofuturistic, you know, in a sense, securing housing. I also work with domestic violence victims. You know, so I'm on the ground doing this work that involves Afrofuturism, in a sense. I mean, it's not sci-fi, but the concern or the issue of our future as a community and as a culture is very much involved in my daily work. After my sort of 9 to 5 job, and I come home and I do, you know, my motherly stuff, but I'm always researching. I'm constantly reading. I'm constantly looking for articles and looking for what's happening, looking for the various thought patterns or things that people are thinking and saying about Afrofuturism, and trying to share it with other people. Because, again, I think you can enter Afrofuturism from any place and have, you know, it's a lens. So there's going to be some overlap in how people think about it and view it, of course, and there's some core values there. But I think there's so many different perspectives and ways to practice Afrofuturism, in a sense that, you know, there's just a wealth of interesting information out there and interesting thoughts and interesting ways that Afrofuturism is being used. So I just try to soak all of that in. You know, I'm just constantly researching and reading and producing, you know, producing my own work and thought and events around Afrofuturism. So that's how I stay fit, you know, in terms of it and keep and trying to keep up with it. But, yeah, it's definitely a daily thing. Running this organization itself is wrapped up in my daily activities, and it is a Afrofuturistic organization by nature. So just by the activities that I'm doing to try to sustain it, I think I'm also learning and practicing.
Awesome. Brittany, do you have a question for Rashida?
Yes. Okay. I didn't know who was next. You were just talking about grants. What do you look for? Like, does people apply, or do you just seek out people when you give them the grants?
People definitely. It's both. It's a little bit of both. So, I work during the day at an organization where we serve all poor people. You know, in various different areas, such as, you know, people who have their utilities cut off and people who need welfare benefits, things like that. So almost daily somebody's in my office and they have needs. And, you know, sometimes there is not a resource out there that covers a small need, like somebody's about to get their lights cut off and they need $100, or, you know, I have a domestic violence victim who's moving to new housing and she can't afford to move. You know, she doesn't have the money for moving costs. So the grant is set up so that people who have an emergency need can apply for it and just get the money, you know, and they don't have to, you know, just being that I do this work daily, I'm sort of already trained and know what to look for in terms of people who have particular needs. So I'm able to sort of, you know, weed out if necessary. But for the most part, you know, I trust that people who are applying are actually in need of it. And it's also not a terrible amount of money. You know, this is not the most lucrative endeavor, which is fine. But all the proceeds, again, that come from the events and any money, we have T-shirts and, you know, my books, go back into the organization and go out towards that grant, so that when people apply, it's applications are accepted on a rolling basis. So, you know, at any time during a year, whatever proceeds we gather from the events that we do throughout the year, somebody needs emergency funds, they apply, our application is online where we can mail it out to people. And I also do a lot of workshops. So when I go out to do workshops on Afrofuturism, I take the grant application and give it to people because usually the workshops are at, you know, communities where there's people in need, you know. So yeah.
Okay.
So Rashida,
really basically.
How does Afrofuturism use escapism and fantasy to discuss larger issues of race, class, gender, and power?
Again, I think it sort of goes back to having a new language, a language that allows us to get into spaces that we normally don't have access to. So thinking, for example, back to the times of slavery and how slavery continues to affect us as people, you know, Afrofuturism allows us to do that. It gives us a language and sort of a vehicle to go back and examine that. So I'm thinking specifically of, like, Octavia Butler's novel Kindred, to where, you know, the Dana travels back or falls back into time, and you get a picture of the South that is accurate, you know, but it's in using the language of fantasy and sci-fi to explore that. So I think that's what Afrofuturism does. It allows us, it gives us a new language. Words have power, you know, have these powers that we don't always give them credit for, that allows us to, you know, not only reexamine the past, but also to create our future, to write about what we want to see in the future, or to make art about what the future looks like, or what we envision, or what we have traveled to. You know, it also gives us the language or the power to look at, you know, for example, I use quantum physics a lot as a metaphor for things, and just the notion of these superimposed realities, or these parallel realities, or, you know, these binaries that we are caught up in, and again, using time travel again to, like, look back at, examine PTSD or examine our personal histories. So I think Afrofuturism just gives us that ability and that language and that power where sci-fi hasn't always, you know, sci-fi has not always been kind to us or depicted us in ways that are affirming, or, you know, so I think Afrofuturism allows us that. And then in terms of escapism, I think, you know, escapism is very important. You know, I think it's a very necessary thing to have, you know, for that child, you know, who's abused or needs a way out or needs to, you know, for me personally, I had a rough childhood, and, you know, reading a book, you know, falling into a book and being taken into other worlds. I mean, of course, eventually I had to come back to where I was, but that moment of escape, that being able to leave and come back and explore other places, I think it's so important, and I think Afrofuturism allows us to do that.
Yeah, definitely.
That kind of segues nicely into my question. I think what I wanted to ask is, I always, again, it's really interesting how I like to see concepts kind of permeate throughout, you know, communities, and, you know, looking to youth, how important, or how do you envision Afrofuturism kind of being implemented into, you know, educational institutions, and, you know, even the recreational activities for Black youth in particular, who consistently feel disenfranchised, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. I think, again, it goes back to having a language, having images, having all of those things that make culture. I mean, I go out and I do workshops with youth on Afrofuturism, and they're so interested in it because, again, it allows them to examine things, you know, in a way that they may not have had the language, you know, because they're getting these images anyway. So they're getting Star Wars, and they're getting Hunger Games, and they're going to go out and see these things. But do they have the tools and the language to critically analyze that, or to critically say, I'm not reflected in this film, and why am I not reflected in it? Why am I not here? How can I be here? What can I do to be reflected in these things that are being said to me? You know, so it allows kids to critically analyze these things that they're already interested in. I mean, again, myself, you know, I was big into sci-fi as a kid, and it wasn't until I was an adult that I realized that I wasn't reflected there, and that was toxic in a sense. You know, it was toxic on my self-esteem and on you know, a lot of things. And I think that happens to kids a lot, and we don't realize it until we're adults, and it kind of feels like it's too late. So I think it gives them images. I think it gives them a new language. It gives them new inspiration. you know, new imagination, a reason to imagine. You know, and I think kids, children of color are just so cut off sometimes from their imagination. And, you know, mm-hmm. Afrofuturism can be free. You know, it can be freeing, and it can be free, and you can go into schools and incorporate these principles without spending money and without, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
I just think it's just full of possibility, and these images are just so exciting. You know what I mean? You look at the art of, like, John Jennings, or you hear Janelle Monáe's song, it's different, it's fresh, it's representing a different side of blackness that kids are not always exposed to if you're just looking at television or listening to music. So it just gives them access to a different type of blackness that's rich and just full of possibility. So I'm just all for continuing to teach our kids sci-fi, and black sci-fi in particular, or multicultural sci-fi or marginalized sci-fi. Yeah, I just think, you know, and if science fiction is supposed to be a parable, or it's supposed to be a representation of what's to come, why are we absent from it? How is that even possible? You know what I mean? So it allows kids to think about that critically and say, why, you know, and the workshops that I've done, I haven't just done them for an audience of black children. There's been black and white kids in there, too, and the white kids are like, whoa, you know, I never thought of it this way either. So that's why I say,
right.
You know, Afrofuturism shouldn't just be, you know, for black people, of course, because we have to live in a society together and we have to coexist, and our cultures bleed into each other. So we just have to be respectful of that. And, you know, thinking about this notion of appropriation, we do have to be very careful about that. I believe in that very strongly. But, you know, there also has to be a way that we can all meaningfully participate in each other's culture, since we have to coexist. So, you know,
right.
That's how I feel about it.
Right. And you mentioned her, and I see a lot of folks on Twitter dropping her name as well. What are your thoughts of Janelle Monáe being described as the new poster child of Afrofuturism? Or is that accurate to say that she is the poster child?
I feel like she represents a lot of the hopes and dreams of what Afrofuturism is and what it can do. You know, just I remember Janelle Monáe back in MySpace days, you know what I mean? And
yeah.
Before she got signed and the stuff she was putting out. And it was mind-blowing. It was like, whoa, I've never seen this. You know, so even if she doesn't call her, I don't know if she identifies with that term. And, you know, I'm not willing to assign that term to her myself. But it's obvious that she plays with those concepts, whether or not you want to call them Afrofuturism or not. You know, she's built her own mythology. She has her own language and stories. And so I think that's really cool. And I think, you know, I think, like, for example, my blog, I think it's okay to sort of interpret art and music and to say, in my eyes, that's Afrofuturism. But we have to just be careful at the same time not to label people who don't want to be labeled that, you know, or people
right.
who haven't affirmatively said I'm an Afrofuturist or my work is Afrofuturism, because people, you know, they have very real concerns about being boxed in, although I don't feel that Afrofuturism boxes people in. But, you know, people have very real concerns about that. So I try to be careful of that and conscious of that myself when I'm reblogging something, as far as, like, putting tags on something. Like, if an artist hasn't explicitly said I'm Afrofuturist, I'm an Afrofuturism artist, I'll try not to put that tag on it, but also recognizing, you know, the give and take that I'm a human with a perspective, and this is my interpretation of your art. So, you know, it's a fine line that you have to walk with that in terms of labeling people or whatever.
My question is, how do you want people to see Afrofuturism? Like, from somebody on the outside who, you know, maybe wants to know, like, how do you want them to see it?
I think I want people to just see Afrofuturism as just ripe with possibility. You know, I just have to continue to emphasize that, because part of the conversation around Afrofuturism is that it can be a limiting concept, or it limits people. I don't want people to see it that way, because I think you don't have to take that on and just be that one thing. I mean, for example, I can write something in the style of an Afrofuturist, but I can also do legal writing because, you know, I'm an attorney, and I can also do philosophical writing, you know, so it's a lens, but you can also take that lens off, you know. And I feel like that concern of being too black, or I feel like that only comes up in our community, you know, sometimes, or like this whole notion of post-blackness or not wanting to be boxed in. But I'm like, I can't separate my experiences from my blackness. Like, I am a black woman. I came up in a world, and all of my experiences are informed by that, because race touches everything, whether we want it to or not. So I feel like there's a responsibility, you know, again, using this language that Afrofuturism has given us, to show that there are other sides to blackness, that there aren't, you know, you don't have to be post-black just to have a positive sense of what blackness is. You know, we can redefine blackness using these languages, or we can expose other areas of blackness using this language. So I just want people to see it as that, as open to possibility, and by it, by virtue of what it is.
Hello?
You know.
Hello.
Yes. Okay. Sorry. Yes. You got silent. I don't know if it's me or you. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hey, Rashida,
Hello.
Can you hear us? Hello?
Yes, I can hear you guys. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you now.
Okay. All right, cool. Yeah, I forget what I was saying, but I think what I was trying to say is that I feel like our experiences are varying experiences as black people are not put out there enough. And so we need artists who are willing to define themselves as black so that we can expand the definition of what blackness is, and so that it is associated with positive imagery, with beautiful imagery. And I just think it's our responsibility to say that blackness is not just hip-hop, it's not just prison culture, drug culture, or slavery. You know, it's all of these things. It's ripe with possibility, and so we can create black art that's still rooted in a black cultural experience, but also that's expansive and concerns any topic, you know. So I think that's what I want people to take away from Afrofuturism, if anything, that it's just open, you know.
Okay. So you just want it to be more like multifaceted, like there's different sides of us pretty much.
Yeah, and one interesting thing that came out was this this essay called Mundane Afrofuturist Manifesto or something like that, and it was just talking about the various tropes that are associated with Afrofuturism and saying that it's not rooted enough essentially in what's here and now. And I don't believe that. I don't agree with that. I think that it does include the here and now. I think what Afrofuturism does is that it takes a different notion of time, you know, because African cultures and African society and their notion of time was very circular. It necessarily involved both the past and the future, whereas in American society and American culture, we sort of just go on a linear path of, you know, the future's behind us, the past is behind us, and the future is in front of us. And I think what Afrofuturism, it takes a different notion of time. It makes time cyclical, and so that we can involve all different aspects of culture at different points in time and say it's here and now, and it's both future and it's both past, and it's all of that is represented here. And it's just open to all of these possibilities of taking inspiration from all of these time periods and all of these different things and spaces.
Awesome. Well, we've got a caller on the line, so I'm going to bring them on. This is area code 323. You're on the air with Black Girl Nerds. What's your name and where are you from?
Hey, how's it going? It's Filmmaker Dean calling from Cali. How y'all doing?
Good. How are you?
Good.
I'm good. I saw this conversation going about Afrofuturism. I definitely want to tune in and listen to you guys. I've seen, we've been having this debate for a long time about, you know, after the movie Frankenstein came out and people didn't get behind it as much and stuff like that. It's like, you know, they expect black people to only write one kind of film and stuff like that. And
right.
You know, I was interested in you guys of thoughts on distribution, because, you know, we have been, as people of color, we have been doing the comic books and stuff like that when it comes to Afrofuturism, whatever. We have been doing the films, but distribution, like, especially over in the UK, they won't even play those kind of films if black faces are in them. You know, it seems like you can't escape, you know, racism or whatever. You know, they say that, you know, they want to see more kind of films and defined, but when we step out of the box and do things besides black narrative films and stuff like that, but just science fiction, for example, we don't get no distribution. You know, I said there are plenty of films out there. I deal with the indie situation stuff, And I was just wondering, you know, you guys' opinion on that, you know, because you got people out there doing this stuff, but they just don't have any distribution. So it's like we don't exist, but we are here.
Right.
Is there any way I can answer that?
Yeah. Go ahead.
That's tough. I mean, you know, it's...
Oh, somebody's breaking up. I don't know what's going on.
No, Brittany, you said Brittany, you said you wanted to answer that question real quick.
Yeah, I can say this from personal experience. I don't know everything about Afrofuturism and everything else, but me personally, there's things that go on in my life that maybe, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on. But like, for example, I'm pregnant, I have a child, and I want to go to school. There might have been people who shut the door on me and say, no, we're not going to let you in. I think a lot of times the problem is you have that one door shut and then you say, okay, that's it. I think that you should still work and work and work. And maybe it's not right then and there, but you make relationships with people and you keep pushing yourself out there, regardless if people won't say yes or, you know, immediately. I think a lot of problems is, we, like I said, we'll get one person say no and we're just defeated. I mean, you should just keep going and keep going and hook up with the right people and make sure that you're still selling yourself regardless of what the situation is. That's it.
And there's another mentality that's kind of going around that I agree with. It's, you know, we can't look too much to these big distributors, i.e. Hollywood, to produce the work that we want to produce. It may take the extra effort on our end as far as using social media, as far as, you know, coming out of our own pockets and finding and doing our own networking to get the money that we need and fundraising, crowdsourcing, all of that kind of stuff, to get our stories told and to get them out there to a wider audience. You know, everyone says the internet is this godsend for letting our voices be heard more. So I think that's kind of the attitude you got to kind of have. It's nice to have that balance. You know, you always are going to go first and see where, you know, you can get distribution that's going to be a little bit, you could have that, you know, process go a little bit more smoother for you, but if doors keep getting shut, you have to kind of open, you have to kind of create your own doors, basically. And I don't think I'm saying anything revolutionary. It's just that is a lot of the people that I know who are producing independent media, I find it refreshing that they're just saying, screw it, I'm just going to keep doing what I'm doing, and things will pan out the way I want them to because this is my goal. So,
yeah, right. I agree with that.
Yep. So the caller, I apologize, I had to mute you because of the feedback, but I'm going to get over to another caller because we've got a few people waiting to speak to us. So this is area code 843. You're on the air with Black Girl Nerds. What's your name and where are you from?
Greetings. My name is Eddie. I'm from South Carolina.
Hey, Eddie. How's it going?
I'm doing well, and congratulations to the Empress that is getting ready to bring a new family member forward.
Oh, that's Brittany.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Thank you.
Indeed. I caught the call kind of late, but I feel that I caught it right on time. I'm new to your organization, at least your blog talk show, but what I wanted to say was all we have to do is create an LLC or a corporation, because there's a lot of people who are into sci-fi, technology, all of that stuff. And I feel it's simple. You know, I'm sure somebody knows somebody in Georgia, South Carolina, California, and all of those things. And you look at how they do things in Africa right now, or how they've been doing it. You know, they'll buy a movie or rent a movie, and then they'll show it and charge admission in a garage or a hut. So we can start exposure like that, and through the corporation, a percentage of that money that's generated goes back to the hub. Then eventually you start buying, you know, small movie theaters. You know what I'm saying? 'Cause,
right. Right.
We are family no matter where we are, you know,
exactly.
And regardless of other people's belief systems, we like what we like, you know, and we shouldn't allow people, or should I say others, to say what we can and can't do. So the only way that we're really going to get things going is for us to work collectively as with ourselves, regardless of how we feel about Kwanzaa. Those are precepts, and they are effective if we agree to use them.
Right. I agree wholeheartedly on that. I mean, I think social media is sort of helping to facilitate us fostering communities together and doing things like podcasting and getting together communities to talk about comic books. I just had a conversation recently with some followers on Twitter about Milestone Comics, which is now a defunct company, but I really think that they should start up again because they were creating comic books about people of color, for people of color, and it just started with a team of people that didn't see comic book characters that look like them. And I just think that that needs to start happening again. So I totally agree with that, absolutely.
Yeah, and if you have access to these people, you should recommend to them to put an ad in the back of their comic book for support, for support and distribution.
Yes.
I like health magazines and things of that nature. And in the back of a few that I've seen lately, they're giving people an opportunity to contract with them to distribute in their area, you know, so that's what assists them in getting exposure. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
You know, I mean, we've been doing it for thousands of years, you know. Nike comes out with a new pair of sneakers. Chrysler comes out with a new car. First thing we do, even before we're able to afford it, is talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because the village expands just like that, just like, you know, back in the day with the drum. You know, that was a way of communication. As technology gets more and more advanced, we tend to get more and more challenged as far as simplicity. You know what I'm saying? And that's another reason
right.
why I really emphasize in reference to the village. Or if you look at Asian people, you know, they got big corporations, they make millions of dollars a year, but if you go to their house, they got that feng shui still going on. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
No,
well,
so,
thank you so much, Eddie. I really appreciate you calling in and giving us this feedback. It's great that you listened in for the first time to the show, and hopefully you keep on listening. And thank you so
Sunday?
Much for your time. Every Sunday, yes.
Okay.
Except
I love
next
and appreciate
Sunday,
you, and I will be here. Excuse me?
Except next Sunday, but yeah, every Sunday. We'll be on.
Oh, well,
so.
Well, where's the party?
All right. Well, take care. You enjoy the rest
Bless
of your day. You. Awesome. Good stuff. So we're about a little less than 3 minutes till the end of the show. I do want to just ask Rashida just some final questions. First of all, tell our listeners about your website, where they can go to find your book, more about what you're doing with the Afrofuturism movement, if you're speaking at any engagements. Where can we find out more information about what you're doing?
Yeah, so we actually just recently revamped the website. You can find it at www.afrofuturistaffair. That's AFROFUTURIST. So it has, like, sort of all of our social networking sites. We're on Instagram. We're on Tumblr, Facebook, everything you can name. If you just type it into Google, it'll bring up stuff. Our next upcoming event is May 10th. We're actually doing a collaboration with the Future Weird film screening series out of Brooklyn, and they have sci-fi experimental films from the Global South and from Africa. So we're going to be doing a screening of two of their film tracks on May 10th in Philadelphia. And we just do events all the time. We have a bunch of different stuff coming up. Simultaneously, I'm sort of promoting my book, and I'm going to be doing some speaking. So I'll be in D.C. on May 2nd at Sankofa Video Art Video Books Cafe. I'm also going to be doing a workshop at the Allied Media Conference in June, from June 19th to June 22nd. I'll be doing a do-it-yourself time travel workshop. I do a lot of workshops around, so you can just sort of check out our calendar and find out what's going on, our upcoming events and everything. And then tune into our Tumblr, which is afrofuturistaffair.tumblr.com, which showcases other people's events and articles and all sorts of images and art. going on in the Afrofuturist community. And, yeah, and you can find my book on the Afrofuturist Affair website or on Amazon or everywhere.
Yay, good, good stuff. Thank you so much, Rashida. Really, thank you.
I really appreciate
for coming on the show.
It.
This was a really great discussion, very informative. So thank you for coming on. We will not have a show next week. We'll be on hiatus. But the following week, May 4th, Sunday, we will have a discussion about Black Twitter. So we'll have a panel on to talk about it. And we're just going to talk about the advent of Black Twitter and how it's just sort of become a mainstream topic among the mainstream media and online journals and websites and all of that fun stuff. So tune in, not next Sunday, but the Sunday after next at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time right here on Blog Talk Radio. Again, thank you to Rashida, and thank you to our co-hosts Ashley and Brittany. You guys are awesome, as always.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
Take
you.
Care, everybody. Have a good night.
I'm finally
Bye.
Free. Finally.